Hello there. Are you sure you're in the right place? See the name on the door? This podcast is Spine Chillers and Serial Killers. Surely you don't want to come in here. You do. Well, I must warn you that things are pretty adult in here. Absolutely no children are allowed. Obscene language, shocking and horrendous stories to chill you to your core, and terrifying tales that'll keep you up at night. The ladies inside aren't quite right. Lovely and hilarious, but very strange. Still want in, do you? Well, you'll get what you're here for. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello and welcome to this week's Spine Chillers and Serial Killers. I'm Tash.
I'm Becky.
Oh my god. Becky, look at that butt.
You can't see my butt. There's nothing to write home about there.
You did recognise that though, right?
I wonder what you were doing at first, I must admit. I was like, what the hell is she doing?
I've been jamming out to Mix-a-Lot, so I had that in my head.
Can't picture you doing that.
Yeah, I was.
I like big butts on a can at last.
I was saying to Ben, oh my god, Becky, and he's like, what's that from? I'm like, I like big butts and I cannot lie. And he's like, oh, okay. So we put it on and then Maddie was like, oh, Mum, did you write that song? Did you invent that song? Is that about your friend Becky?
You were like,
yes, I am indeed Sir Mix-a-Lot. It is me. It is me. Hello.
I don't know how old I was when that song came out, so.
I don't even know when it came out.
I don't know. I thought it was the 80s. Maybe not that old.
No.
I have no idea.
A few things before we get on to Tash.
Yep.
Cara Beth. You know, I was talking about whistling at night at my dogs and.
Yep.
Hearing over the hill somebody like mimic my whistle. Cara Beth said, actually, there is a legend that says you're not supposed to whistle at night because you are calling a skinwalker towards you. And I was like, oh, okay, there's me not whistling ever again. But she made me laugh because she then added, sometimes I still do though. As if she, I don't know. I was like, you badass Cara Beth. Like, just fuck it. Sometimes I'm going to whistle. She's like, if I think about it too much, though, I make another noise, like maybe a click.
Oh, and your voice went all weird as you tried to explain that. So I reckon that the mimic is trying to interfere with your...
Fuck off.
He's telling us that. Did you hear that too, Tash?
I did.
It went... I'm so like that when you were speaking.
That's just my voice. That's just how I sound.
That's what a mimic would say.
Am I even me? You don't know.
I don't know. To be fair, your story last week is the one that stuck with me for the longest time, because I kept thinking about it every single day since.
Did it keep you up a little bit?
A little bit.
Do you know, last week I was saying that my Furby said something really sinister, and Tash was like, I don't believe that.
She was so like, that's a load of shit.
Well,
I don't think I was that aggressive about it.
No, but you didn't want to believe it. You were like, I can't believe that. I can't have that in my life right now. Stop it.
Yes, that was more my reaction, I think. Mm.
But I was filming my kids being absolute idiots. And in the background was said Furby, who did exactly the same thing. And I sent the video proof to Tash and Becky. So we know I wasn't bullshitting. It did say...
I did think it said I like pie, though.
It said I was dreaming... that you died. It probably said, I was dreaming I like pie.
That's a weird thing to say as well.
It is a bit
weird. I mean, regardless, it's weird because isn't your Furby French?
Yeah, picked up, and we don't understand. It's always spoken English.
There's so many reasons this whole situation is weird.
Anyway, so Furby's now made it into the recording room and he is on
Is that him behind you?
Yeah.
Oh, so when he randomly turns on? Oh, right. Okay.
Well, he hasn't got any batteries. If he turns on, I will not be happy. Yes, he's joined the...
It's gone really hot as you said that.
The Teddy Shelf, Carl the Furby.
I think I'm going to have to work on my background because honestly, like the random window and the weird little door. I took the dress off the door in the background again.
You did?
Yeah. And I think I need to make an effort.
Do you remember? I mean, how can you forget the Alaskan pirate?
I listened to it about 3 times. Hello from Alaska.
Bless her. She loved it. She was not offended by it, which was a big relief. And her name is actually Alicia. So hi, Alicia.
Hi.
Hello.
She said she will write in each time if you do voiceovers in any accent. So you need to get practicing those accents.
Oh, I'll have to have a go.
She said she's been listening to the podcast since the foreskin, forensic, forcenic, that
forcenic
debacle.
The shebang.
Yeah. She didn't realise that her username was user whatever.
567. Yeah,
whatever. Until we'd read it out loud. So her name is actually Alicia. And yeah, thanks for commenting on YouTube because our YouTube channel needs some love.
It does.
Get loving it, babies.
Get loving it.
Give me all your loving.
Okay, well, that's me done. Tash, you have a broken arm.
I have a broken arm, everybody. I'm soldiering on with my broken arm.
It's all that wrestling. Arm wrestling with Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah, that's not how I did it. Who would like to hear the story of how I broke my arm?
We do.
So the girls don't know yet. I haven't told the girls. I decided that I would tell them on the podcast. So it's Friday morning. I've been treated to a later start at work. So obviously when that happens, you don't actually have more time in the morning. You're actually running late, aren't you? Because you procrastinate, you take longer to get ready, whatever. Then as I'm downstairs, I've put the dog in her room, locked up the back door, and then I see the gardener arrive. I panic. I think, oh shit, there's loads of dog poo in the garden. Run out into the garden, open the back gate for him, go back in the house, get poo bags. The dog runs into the garden. I try to grab her, fall over, break my arm. I am so embarrassed that I've fallen over. You know when you do that and he's like, are you okay? I'm like, yep, I'm fine. Grab the dog in, carry on picking up the poo. I did get poo on my hand because normally I'd use two bags. But I only used one bag to pick up the poo. Go in the house, try to put my socks on and think, I can't move my arm.
Oh, no.
Yeah, turns out I have broken my elbow, which is very painful and I wouldn't recommend it to a friend.
No.
Several people have asked if that's the real story. I feel like I've got a bit of a reputation and that people don't believe that the gardener wasn't more involved in the story.
You were literally just rushing to pick up shit. And grab the dog.
I did get shit on my finger.
Who hasn't had shit on their finger, to be fair?
Who's not had shit on their finger?
Did you wash your hand, though, before you went to the hospital and you were like, doctor, I've hurt my arm. And, like, shoved it right under his face.
I don't know how I washed both of them, but I did.
I think you'd find a way if you've got shit on your hand.
Yeah.
If you just find a way.
So, yeah, that's me.
In a sling.
I've not got a cast, I've got a sling, because the type of break I've done, I have to keep my arm mobile. Otherwise, it will heal in a dodgy position. So, yeah, this is fun.
You didn't cry?
Not initially.
No.
No, because I was so embarrassed. Yeah. It's embarrassing falling over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I cried in the hospital. I was seen really quickly. Like, I was in and out of the hospital within 2 hours. The longest part was waiting at the pharmacy for my medication. As I walked in to get an x-ray, the radiologist was hilarious. I knocked on the door. It was a man in scrubs and he went, hello, welcome to Helga's House of Pain. I went, I don't know if I want to be here. And he went, now's the bit where I get to torture you. And I was really like, I'm really laughing on the inside, but it really hurts. I went, thank you for trying to be funny.
Oh, bless
him. So he was lovely. But yeah, that's my story. I have taken about 45 minutes ago my pain relief, which is quite strong, and I get quite high on it. So who knows what's going to happen today.
If you start slurring your words, we won't be worried.
Start slurring or like falling asleep, or I might just be really silly.
Aww.
Anyway, I'll be fine. Poor I just gosh. Like the attention, really.
You deserve
the things
a bit
you
of
do
attention.
For attention.
I know. Anyway, who wants a It's Gross by Tash or whatever the name of the segment is?
Me. Hang on. Me.
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 This is so gross. Oh, I feel really sick. That's a no from me. It's disgusting. Oh. Gross things that happen on planes.
Oh, God, no.
As always, this is a thread that I have found. I have done none of these things, but I will read it as it was written.
Yeah, it's going to be about feet. It's going to be about feet.
I was on a transatlantic flight a couple of years ago, and the man in the seat behind me took his shoes and socks off right after takeoff and propped his stinky, complete with crusty toenails.
Oh, God, no.
On my armrest. I shut that down immediately and told him under no circumstances were his crusty feet going to be sitting on my armrest for the next 7 hours.
Good for you.
He moved his feet back to the floor, but didn't put his shoes and socks back on.
Gross.
So I kept getting a whiff of his stinky feet.
Oh, no.
Gross.
That actually makes my stomach churn because minging feet makes me feel sick.
Yeah, me too. I complained to the flight attendant not long after. The two people next to me spoke up as well, and she told Stinky Feet Man to put his socks back on. Thankfully, he complied. I'm honestly not sure what I would have done if he'd been more of a jerk about it. Why do people think it's acceptable to take their shoes off on planes?
No self-awareness.
If you know that your feet don't smell, I think shoes, okay, reasonably enough. But socks... And
never socks.
Never socks.
Never socks.
Just wear flip-flops then.
Yeah.
And, but then again, planes...
So cold. So
and
cold.
And filthy.
Yeah,
filthy.
Gross.
The reason why he's got crusty toenails is because he keeps taking his fucking socks off. He's getting all of the fungal infection.
Oh, God! Oh,
toe jammy, toe cheese, toe camembert, toe brie. All the cheeses are on his feet.
Don't like it.
It's not nice.
No.
The next story I've got.
Don't be a dick. Keep your socks on.
Yeah. I've only got two on this one. On this thread, because all of the others were like very short, like
I knew it would be feet. I knew it would.
Yeah. My husband and I took a trip to Maui when I was about 14 weeks pregnant with our first child, a babycation, if you will. While we were waiting for our delayed flight home, a young hipster type man passed us in the waiting lobby, and every single soul waiting covered their mouth and their nose and immediately began to point and whisper. This kid, early 20s maybe, smelt absolutely awful. I mean, the worst BO I can think is humanly possible.
Oh, God.
It hung in the air for ages after he passed. With my uber-sensitive pregnant nose, I was disgusted. But we walked around a bit pre-flight and moved on. Fast forward to boarding. Here he comes. Here comes the motherfucking plane stinker. At the time he is coming, my husband and I are taking post-Hawaii selfies on the plane. the exact moment that the plane's stinker sits down in the open seat next to me is captured. It's priceless. My hormonal pregnant senses are going wild, and it's such a terrible smell that I just started to cry.
Oh no, bless her!
Oh. Awful though. But can you imagine? That would happen, wouldn't it, when you're pregnant?
Yeah.
My husband is embarrassed by me and is mad that I'm crying, but I give zero fucks.
Oh, it's fuck gross. Him.
It's nasty. People around us are asking to be changed seats. I wrap a scarf around my face the whole flight home and bury my face into my husband's arm. It is still the worst smell to this day that I've ever smelt.
Oh, that's horrendous.
How awful's that?
That's that is awful. Days and days of no washing.
Do people that smell like that know they smell?
I don't know.
I just don't think they care.
You wouldn't willingly smell. Because a smell and smell, right? Like, if you've got a bit sweaty one day and you've got a tiny bit of BO, you've got that smell.
That can happen to anyone.
I'll be honest. A man that's been at work all day and smells a little bit, I think sexy.
It can be.
It can be.
But it's same day pheromones, sweat, isn't it?
Yeah, same day sweat.
Like same day sweat, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, oh, you sniff those armpits.
Yeah.
Not armpits. Probably not armpits. Like,
isn't it weird?
What's wrong with us?
Oh, it's sexy. That wood chopper, I'd like to smell his armpits.
Oh, have you seen the girl that does the wood chopping? She's quite
hot.
Yeah,
we've talked about this before.
Have we?
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah.
Anyway, this is a serious podcast about serious matters.
Let's get down to stories.
Okay. And it's me to start this week.
I think so.
So I had... Oh my God, I had a process this week because I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to do The Mothman because it's such a fantastic and interesting story, The Mothman.
And a deep dive, isn't it?
It is, yeah, yeah. And I was like, right, I'm going to attack it. We're going to do this. But then I get to a point in The Mothman and it talks about something else that's not The Mothman. And I'm like, that is also a very interesting subject. And if people don't know what that is, it doesn't make it as creepy in the actual The Mothman story. So you're not getting The Mothman this week. This week you're getting Men in Black. Because they make an appearance.
Here come the Men in Black.
I knew there was absolutely no way you weren't going to sing that.
Na, 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 na. Yeah, but that's going to be in my head now. I had it in my head earlier in the week. That's so weird. Last week I had it in my head. Thoughts.
I think we are. We've got this little telepathic link going on.
I was cooking and I was going, here comes. I know why. It's because it's on an advert for French insurance. You know, La Maf.
Yeah.
It goes, no, c'est la meuf, or something like that.
Oh, okay.
So that must be why. I reckon that's why we're not that linked then, I suppose.
Oh,
sorry.
No, that's just ruined it.
Ruined everything.
Yeah.
Cut it out.
Shitty advert. Just shit. You don't know me at all.
You don't know me.
So, when you hear Men in Black, I'm sure your mind jumps to Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones protecting the world from an alien threat.
Hoya.
And it did. You just proved that it did. But the truth about the Men in Black is a lot more sinister and menacing. Generally speaking, they are all dressed the same in a black suit and a fedora hat, although there are some differences in attire occasionally. They have light olive skin, very neutral and expressionless facial features. They speak in a monotone, almost robotic way, and the way they move seems quite off. A bit like our horrendous friends from last episode, the Mimics. These guys seem to be pretending really hard to look human, but not quite managing it. A waitress was serving a table of three of these odd men in black and said they looked very confused about using a knife and fork, and once they managed to get the food in their mouths, they just swallowed it without chewing.
They've obviously been watching me eat. Well.
They tend to turn up at people's houses after they've witnessed a UFO or other strange paranormal activity, but mainly anything that appears to be extraterrestrial. During the encounters, the witness will be told that under no uncertain terms should they talk about what they saw. The idea that something bad will happen if they do is very strongly hinted at. The men in black are often in groups of three or more and drive around in black Cadillacs. They sometimes say that they work for the government, and whether this is true or not, we can't be sure, but it reassures people enough to let them in their house before realizing that these things slash men slash creatures are seriously weird and disturbing.
Ooh. Well, we're going mimic again.
Well, it's not. Well, yeah, they kind of are.
Ish.
Yeah, it's like mimic on a mission.
Mimics have missions too.
Well, apparently they do. They work for the federal government, apparently.
Normal mimics are just like the hippie version of the men in black. They're the freelancers, and men in black, they work for the mimic government.
And what about the black-eyed kids?
What about the black-eyed peas?
I mean, now we're just being ridiculous. This first account is actually the first time someone saw a man in black. Harold Dahl worked on the Puget Sound, and I was going to look that up, and I didn't, so I'm hoping it's Puget Sound, which apparently after
sounds
I...
Sounds right to me.
Well, after what I gather, it's a river, I think. It's something to do with water.
I thought it was a music label for some reason. Did you not just say Puget Sound?
Puget Sound.
Puget Sound music labels.
So he collected logs that had fallen off lumber ships. On the 21st of June 1947, he was on his boat with his son and the family dog when he saw six metallic donut-shaped flying crafts in the sky. He watched as five of the crafts circled the six that slowly flew lower towards his boat. He drove the boat to shore as he was afraid that the craft would crash into his boat. It was then that he got out his camera and snapped a few pics. The weird flying saucers just kind of hovered there until one dropped a lot of debris. Harold thought it looked like paper, but when some came ashore, he picked it up and realised it was actually a really lightweight white metal. The craft then dropped around 20 tons of dark metal that was so hot, when it hit the ocean, it exploded. So maybe the Puget Sound is like a port or something like that?
I don't know. Could be.
If you know what the Puget Sound is, I'm really sorry I didn't do my research properly. I was going to, and then I forgot.
It happens. It's fine.
So, because it was so hot, hits the ocean, explodes. Some of the debris hit his son's arm, and it burnt him.
Youch.
Yep. And some more hit their dog, and it killed the dog instantly.
Oh, no.
No.
Nobody likes a dead dog.
You can't start your story with a dead dog.
Sorry.
Or end a story with a dead dog. No dead dogs.
No dead dogs. Is that the rule from now on? No more.
There's no dead dogs in my story, so it's okay.
Once it had finished its metal drop, all the crafts flew away together. Once out of sight, Harold and his son sailed back to their dock, dropping the dog's body overboard for a burial at sea.
What the fuck?
People, eh?
Just like, what should we do with this now? Oh, well, Chuck. Poor little thing.
Once on dry land, he drove his son to the hospital to treat the burn. And then he told his boss, Fred Chrisman, exactly what had happened. He, of course, didn't believe Harold. So he passed him the camera and said, get those developed and you'll see. And indeed he did. And the photos came out somewhat damaged, but you could clearly see the six flying aircrafts. Chrisman decided to go to Maury Island himself. So Maury Island is the island that they kind of took cover on when they went to shore, and see if he could find some of this mysterious metal. And he did. He noticed a donut-shaped UFO flying slowly overhead as if it was watching him. Whilst Chrisman was gathering evidence to back up his employee's claims, Harold got a visit from a strange man dressed in a black suit. The man asked Harold if he'd like to go for breakfast to talk about what had happened over the Puget Sound. He agreed and he followed the black Buick, so it's not a Cadillac this time, it's a Buick, in his own car. Once at the diner, the man began explaining that he knew exactly what had occurred and described everything that Harold had seen in great detail. He then said, "Bad things will happen to you and your family if you talk about this to anyone."
Sounds like a threat.
Just a little bit. Not heeding this warning, Harold and Fred sent off a box of the metal fragments and a written account of what had happened to a publisher, who in turn sent it off to a ufologist called Kenneth Arnold. Around this time, Harold's son went missing. He was eventually found waiting tables in Montana, but bizarrely had absolutely no recollection of how he'd got there. I mean, that's weird. Like, once he's tracked down, he's like, "I actually have no idea why I'm here or why I'm doing this."
That's weird.
Almost as if they'd got out a little cylinder silver thing and flashed his eyes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Will Smith.
Slappy slappy.
I bet he wished that he'd had that at that point. Yes. Oh, everyone can just forget
everybody
about that.
Everybody just look at this and bing, there we go.
Look here.
The story eventually reached the Air Force, who sent two officers to come and investigate. After all, this could be a threat for national security. The officers thought there might be something to the event and took some of the metal fragments away with them. Sadly, they never arrived at their destination as their plane crashed and both men were killed.
Oh.
What?
The FBI then got interested and began investigating the crash. They established that it was an accident, that one of the engines had caught fire, causing one of the wings to break off and the plane to spin and crash. People around the area of the crash said they'd heard the plane getting shot down.
Ooh. Who to believe?
Mm-hmm. The FBI basically forced Harold and Fred to confess to all of this just being a hoax by saying if they didn't, they would press charges for fraud that caused the death of two officers. The men admitted it was all a lie, and that was the end of the Maury Island incident. Just as a man in black had warned, bad things did indeed happen. In 1950, however, Fred gave an interview to Fate magazine stating that the story had happened, just like they had originally said, but that they'd been forced to say it was all a hoax.
Well, yeah, if you kind of been threatened by the FBI and all this, you'd kind of be like, yeah, it was a hoax. Mm. Let's just make all this go away. Mm.
Absolutely. So, yeah, that was all very strange. Also, what are they dumping into the ocean that's, like, red hot and 20 tons of it? It's a bit of a worry.
Killing dogs.
Well, yeah, killing dogs. Bit of a worry.
Well, what aren't they dumping into the ocean?
I mean, yes, probably. It's probably nothing worse than what we're already dumping, so. Now on to the next very uncomfortable MIB encounter. That's what they call, when you're in the know and you know what Men in Black are, it's MIB.
Like, that's what was on the DVD.
Oh, well, there you go. They knew what they were talking about.
That's because they were in the know.
So this happened in Maine in 1976 to a Dr. Herbert Hopkins. So Dr. Hopkins was a renowned allergist and had done years of research on finding treatments for multiple sclerosis. Recently, however, he had started using hypnosis and found it fascinating. He was working UFO teleportation, consulting with people who said to have been abducted. His research was keeping him up at night, as the more people he spoke to under hypnosis, the more difficult he was finding it to debunk. On September 11th, he received a phone call from a man who claimed to be the vice president of the New Jersey UFO Research Organization.
Someone's got to do it.
Exactly. And this guy was doing it. He was vice president. He said he didn't even get the top job. It was just vice.
Yeah.
He said he was ringing from a phone booth and would love to come and talk with Dr. Hopkins.
It's a weird thing to specify. I'm ringing from a phone booth. I haven't got much money. I better be quick.
I think he was implying that he wasn't that far away.
All right, okay.
So Dr. Hopkins was intrigued and excited to talk about his findings with a fellow enthusiast, so he agreed. He tells the man his address and goes to switch the porch light on so the man will know which house it is. And as the doctor turns the light on, he sees that the man is already right in front of his house. This is really weird because the nearest phone booth is several blocks away. And of course, he couldn't have used a mobile phone as it didn't exist yet. So that should have been his first red flag. And yet, he opened the door and let the man inside. Dr. Hopkins' dog began barking incessantly at the man and didn't stop until he left. This was odd, as usually his dog was extremely well behaved and friendly. The stranger was immaculately dressed in a black suit, white shirt, black tie and a black fedora that he took off inside the house, which is when the doctor realised that this man had no hair. And I don't mean bald, I mean no hair at all. No eyelashes, no eyebrows, nothing.
He could have alopecia.
He absolutely could have alopecia. His skin was also extremely pale, except for his lips that were bright red as if he had applied lipstick.
Ooh. I don't know, it's a bit like a mime, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's not painting a pretty picture. His ears were tiny, as was his nose, and neither seemed to be in the right place on his face, either just a little too high or just a little too low. So, like, they were just off.
Just off, yeah.
Yeah.
That, along with no eyebrows and everything, kind of makes you look a bit, you know, odd.
All in all, this man looked very odd. They sat in the lounge in opposite chairs. The discussion was very strange. This guy seemed to know details about the doctor's work that only people involved would know. And every time Dr. Hopkins answered one of his questions, he replied with the exact same sentence. Yes, that is how I understand it. At one point, the man wiped his lips, smudging lipstick across his face and revealing that, in fact, he had no lips at all. Herbert Hopkins was now extremely uneasy and wanted this person to go away, which I think we can all agree.
Yeah, there was mounting red flags here. He shouldn't have let him in. First rule of a horror film.
No. The man then pointed at the doctor's pocket, saying, "You have two coins in there," which was true. He asked the doctor to remove one and hold it in his hand. The doctor obliged. I think at this point he would have been too scared to refuse. "Watch the coin," demanded the man. As the doctor looked at the coin, it began spinning, and then it became fuzzy, and it changed colour, and then it vanished entirely. The stranger said that that coin will never be seen again in this plane of existence. He then asked Hopkins if he knew of Barney Hill. Do you remember Barney Hill from the Barney and Betty Hill abduction? It's a very, very, it's what I think it was one of our first episodes. And I think Tom was on that episode with us. And you joked about how alien technology could make silent vibrators because they made silent aircraft.
Oh, did I? Why would I say that?
Yes, you did.
No, lies.
Betty and Barney Hill.
Wasn't it him?
Very, very famous.
Wasn't it him that was abducted though first? Or was it her?
They were both taken at the same time.
I think I vaguely remember.
Yeah, it only kind of came out under hypnosis. So, this dude asks Hopkins if he knows of Barney Hill. Of course he did. The Betty and Barney Hill abduction case was very famous. "Do you know what happened to him?" asked the man. "Only that he died recently," replied Hopkins. "Yes, Barney Hill doesn't have a heart, just like you don't have a coin," said the man.
Ooh, sounds like a threat.
I know. That's creepy.
I can just imagine him like,
he then gently
doesn't have a heart like you don't have a coin. I don't know, just like going off into the distance. I don't know. Ooh, eerie.
He then gently suggested that the doctor should get rid of all his work on the UFO abductions and got up to leave. As he spoke, his speech was slurred, and he said, "My energy is running low. I must go now. Goodbye."
That's what I'm going to say when I leave work tomorrow. "My energy is running low. I'm going to go. Bye-bye."
He left immediately, and when the doctor rushed behind him to watch him leave, he had already vanished into the night.
Completely. He robbed him. Came over and made his coin disappear. Yoink.
It was a penny. It was a penny.
Stealing, stealing. Starts at a penny, then what does he do after that? I didn't like that man. And then he left too quickly.
He was not cool, was he?
As well.
Like,
bye.
I must go now, bye. Had this been a normal interaction, the doctor probably wouldn't have paid it much attention. But the fact that whoever had just been in his house had nothing really human about him made him destroy all his files and recordings and stopped working on UFO cases altogether. He later found out that, of course, the New Jersey UFO Research Organization did not exist.
Duh. Duh.
Duh. The third story is a weird one for sure. It concerns a man called Albert K. Bender.
Okay.
A strange and eccentric man who lived in the attic of his stepfather's three-story home in Bridgeport. He was chief timekeeper at a scissor factory. I had to look up what a timekeeper is. And it's somebody that, like, organize, you know, the like the time slips that everybody has to like click in, punch in and stuff.
What was he that person before they had a machine to do it?
I think he just like made sure everybody had punched in when they had to and done enough hours, and I think he sorted out people's paychecks and stuff.
All right, make sure everyone's doing their hours.
Yeah.
Sounds like a really cool. It's a really cool title, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
The timekeeper.
Chief timekeeper. I am the keeper of the time.
I want him to walk around in a cloak with a staff.
Yes. Yeah. And whether it was to be funny or if he really did have a true love for clocks, I don't know, but he filled his space with 20 of them and set them all with different chimes to ring out every 15 minutes.
That's what I'd do to fuck my colleagues.
That's just annoying.
I just think he was a massive prankster.
He also decorated his realm with fake skulls, shrunken heads, and outsider art. So I had to... And the outsider art was done by him. I had to look it up. And it's art by non-trained artists, often by children or mentally ill people. So it's probably art that's a bit weird.
You think?
Yeah. When he had... Oh, it gets worse. Hang on. When he had friends over to visit, he would set the scene by playing a soundtrack of sobbing, thunder, and hissing noises on his record player.
See, I quite liked him at the beginning with his cloak and his wizardry, and then he's gone weirder and weirder.
Can you imagine?
Let me just set the scene. That was the crow from last week.
Can you just imagine you go around your mate's house and he's like, oh, let me just put on some of my favourite music, and it's just a woman going...
Banger, this one.
And hissing, what the fuck? Is that just somebody going...
Snake, a slivery snake.
Fucking weird.
Snake.
He was, of course, fascinated by ghost stories and loved horror movies and claimed to have witchcraft flowing through his veins. He called his attic room the Chamber of Horrors.
I mean, not a very imaginative name, is it?
It's not.
No.
In tune with his very strange personality, he was interested in UFOs and created the International Flying Saucer Bureau, of which he was president. So, you know, at least he's gone straight to the top. None of this vice president shit.
But didn't he create that and make it himself? So obviously he's going to make himself president.
Yes, yes, that is
correct. It's like if I created the best clubhouse ever, I named it the best clubhouse ever, and I'm the president.
Yeah.
You know. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Where are we going with this crazy, kooky guy?
His organisation gathered 600 members worldwide and was quite successful.
That was quite impressive, actually.
He put out a quarterly journal called Space Review that explored any sightings and theories about UFOs. Almost immediately after creating the organisation, Bender began having strange things happen. Phone calls with no one on the other end, He reported receiving telepathic messages and being made to feel very ill. His attic would fill up with the foul smell of sulphur, and once, whilst out at the movies, he noticed a man with glowing eyes staring at him. Despite all of this, Bender decided that to connect with the aliens, the best thing would be that all his members recite a message that he had written in their minds all together at the same time. This would be called World Contact Day, or C-Day for short. The message went like this. Calling occupants of interplanetary craft that have been observing our planet Earth, we of IFSB wish to make contact with you. We are your friends. Interesting fact, C-Day is still held today by UFO enthusiasts with the same message every year on March 15th.
Oh, so we missed it this year.
We did.
That's a shame. It was a month ago today.
Aliens terrify me. I would not be one of them. I mean, yes, yeah, but...
I don't want to go.
You don't want to go? Go
I
where?
I don't want to do that. Oh, yeah. Anywhere.
I just don't want to do anything yeah. or anywhere. Anything. No. No, they do terrify me. It really does. Because that's the thing, like, if one of them wants to abduct you, you just... You're fucked. You're getting abducted and that's yeah. it. Anyway, this message that they'd all kind of recited in their heads on the same day at the same time didn't go down like he had hoped. His attic room began to fill with yellow mist and the smell of sulfur was even stronger than before. Telepathically, he was being told to stop interfering with things that did not concern him.
Ooh.
And still, Bender continued to produce his newsletter, proclaiming that he had big news coming. He never did publish whatever big news he had, because before he had a chance, he was visited by three men in black. They appeared in his room in a yellow mist and told him to stop his research immediately. They confiscated copies of his newsletter and vanished, leaving behind the stench of sulphur he had come to know so well.
Doesn't sulphur smell like rotten eggs, though?
Yeah.
Not a very nice welcome smell, is it? Smellish smell.
No.
Doesn't give home-baked bread energy, does
thinking
it?
Thinking of the hippie guy from earlier on the plane.
Yeah. Bender was scared to death and couldn't eat anything for 3 days. He was plagued with headaches, extreme anxiety, and the feeling of always being watched. And this all forced him to shut down his organisation after a year and a half after its creation. The final issue of Space Review was released in October 1953. It included a cryptic message and a warning. The mystery of the flying saucers is no longer a mystery. The source is already known. But any information about this is being withheld by orders from a higher source. We would like to print the full story in Space Review, but because of the nature of the information, we have been advised in the negative. We advise those engaged in saucer work to be very cautious. And these three cases are just a drop in the ocean. There are hundreds of witness accounts out there, each one as bizarre and as menacing as the next. So if you ever see something in the sky that doesn't look right, maybe just think to yourself, oh, a UFO, that's cool, and move the fuck on. Because I, for one, definitely do not want to have a Men in Black encounter.
No.
And there you go. The Men in Black.
Here go the Men in Black.
Have you ever seen a UFO, either of you?
I don't think so.
Don't think so.
And I'm not going to talk about
it. That's
boring. If I do.
Good point. Anyway, there you go. I'm done. So the next recording, we will learn all about the Mothman. It's a fantastic story. Tragic, but it's very, very interesting. And there's some Men in Black in there, and now you'll know what I'm talking about.
We won't just think of Will Smith. We will know the full story.
Yeah. Like bald, lipless, robotic, creepy motherfuckers.
The lip thing was horrible, and I don't want to think about that again.
Okay. I won't talk about any more lipless men.
What is it with you and lips? The lady with the purple lips? This lipless man?
Well, mouths are a scary thing.
Hello.
Fuck. For everybody that's not like, well, I don't know, you can't see us, so...
What?
Becky and Tash are just like goldfish, like pretending they haven't got lips and just like smacking their... Oh, it's very odd. They're very strange.
You forget that we're on camera and that other people might see. And Tasha's on painkillers. I have no excuse.
I keep looking at my eyes thinking they're getting smaller and smaller.
Yeah, Tasha is like actually fucked. She's absolutely off her tits. She is.
Yeah, I am.
Did you just take your socks off,
no,
Becky?
No, this is my laundry chair for all the bits of, like, random socks that are clean, but I don't know where the other one is. So I put it on this chair. So it's just, I just pulled it out.
Because we said earlier, always socks. Always socks.
Always socks. Never.
Don't go getting too comfortable.
Got socks on.
You minger.
I mean, it's my house.
I'm joking.
I also can't put socks on.
Exactly. You can't put them on.
Only so. Use two hands to put socks on.
I mean, I reckon you could do it with one, but it'd be a faff.
Oh, I'd just take forever. I can't be asked to do that. I'll
can't
just
be asked. No. Yeah, good old Crocs.
I don't know how Emma's going to cut that in, but Tash had to leave because of her broken arm and painkillers. She was just still in too much pain. So we've sent her off. To La La Land, to go to sleep.
Yeah, sleepy bye-bye.
Night, sis.
Right.
Right, so my story this week is horrific.
Oh, great! Wonderful.
But yeah, it's a heart-wrenching story, but it needs to be told. So yeah, let's get into it. So what do you think when you think of Canadians, Emma?
Nice, I think.
Yeah.
Maple syrup, mousse. Do you say mousse?
Maple syrup mousse. Oh, but that's really nice, maple syrup mousse. Oh, yeah. How do you say more than one mousse? Is it just mousse?
Is it mousses?
Or meese?
Mousse. No, I bet it's mousse. It must be mousse. Mousses is silly.
Mousse with an X.
And geese. That's what I think about.
I don't know if we've spoken about this on the podcast, but very, very quickly, moose. Have you seen how big moose are?
We have spoken about this before, and they're fucking ginormous.
And the dimension that they can dive in down up to 9 feet underwater.
I didn't know that. Are they swimming with the capybaras?
I think you might have said that. I think we've done this before. I think we've definitely spoken about this before.
I don't think I compared a
massive deja vu.
It must be deja vu. But yes, yeah. I know they're impressively big. Because I thought they were just like deer size, but they're not. They're more like elephant size.
XXL. Deer on steroids.
Yeah.
Massive.
Wouldn't want to fuck with a moose.
No. But when you think of Canadians, you think nice people. Happy, would do anything for you. So they're like the world's sweethearts of the Canadians.
Yeah.
So, well, Canada often enjoys a reputation of safety, friendliness worldwide. It's evident that the nation is not immune to violence, bullying, and tragedy.
Is it about
this
bullying?
Got me to reflect.
I hate bullies.
Yeah, on the case of Rena Virk. She was born on the 10th of March 1983 to Suman and Manjeet Virk, immigrants from India who settled in Canada. Rena was the eldest of three children. She spent her formative years in View Royal, a community near Greater Victoria, with over 11,000 residents. Unlike many other Indian families in Canada who follow Hinduism or Sikhism, Rena's parents actually became Jehovah's Witnesses when she was young, which for Indians living in Canada made them... quote, a minority within a minority.
I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah. So growing up in a household adhering to strict Jehovah's Witness principles meant that Rena faced very strict rules at home, including obviously no smoking, swearing, celebrating holidays or birthdays, which is sad as fuck.
Do they not celebrate birthdays?
Apparently not.
Have they just got no joy? Just like, no
I just,
joy.
I mean, I don't want to judge other people's.
Well, no, it's not judging.
I'm just thinking, you only live once. Enjoy life. Have a birthday.
I struggle with it because I'm an atheist, I guess.
Yeah.
But if your belief is so deep that you have to behave this way or else you're going to burn in eternal hell.
Well, I think that's what it is. They're doing this in this life so that their eternal life is safe and that they can go to heaven. I think that's why they live in such stricter rules.
We wouldn't fit in.
No, well, I'm not a Jehovah's Witness, and I would not. No. It's not my thing. Not for me.
I love a good birthday cake.
Yeah, so do I. That's just like birthday cake. I suppose they could just buy a birthday cake.
Are they allowed cake, though?
That's the thing. I don't know. Right, so also that was forbidden at home, certain forms of music and clothing, a certain type of clothing. Imposing additional challenges for a teenage girl already struggling with self-confidence and bullying by that time. So from elementary to middle school, Rena endured relentless bullying due to her appearance and ethnicity, leading to internalized anger, depression, and confrontations with her peers. The prolonged harassment deeply affected her sense of self, causing heartbreak for her parents, witnessing their daughter endure such turmoil every day. In 1994, the Virk family, seeking a fresh start, relocated to a different neighbourhood. Enrolled in Rena at Burnside Elementary School, initially the change seemed promising, and this offered hope for new friendships and stability. However, Rena's newfound happiness was short-lived when one of her closest friends betrayed her trust. They fell out and then this person, started bullying her again. So when she graduated to middle school, Rena found her place with a group of, rebellious teens, preteens. They were the kids who liked to drink, smoke, skip school, and push back against authority.
Everything she's not allowed to do.
Yeah. And also, she is desperate to find acceptance. So if she can kind of fit in with this crowd, they're not the best, but they're accepting her at the minute.
Well, no, I absolutely 100% get it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So desperate to find acceptance, Rena altered her behaviour to align with her peer group. A move that also served as a form of rebellion against her parents with their strict religious beliefs. She began drinking, smoking, and challenging authority. Every time I say the word authority, I think of authority from Cartman. Respect my authority. And also she's reaching the age 13, 14 when you kind of wanting to be independent. You're wanting to break away from your parents' hold on you.
Yeah.
And obviously my parents are not Jehovah's Witness, so nowhere near as strict. So despite her parents' earnest efforts to guide her according to Jehovah's Witness principles, reminding her of the rules and sharing scriptures, Rena's desire to rebel only intensified. Each reminder and scripture reading seemed to fuel her defiance further, deepening the divide between her and her family. I've kind of dramatised it a little bit with that, but it's just basically typical teenage rebellion, angst and all this.
Yeah.
Normal.
Absolutely.
And also, she's a little bit traumatised from all the bullying that she's had to endure.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Desperate to escape her parents' home and the suffocating grip of the constant bullying, which was also exacerbated by their strict religious adherence, because they're kind of guilting her at home to adhere to their rules, and then she's still being bullied for all this as well at school, and so she felt isolated and unsupported. And in her youthful naivety, she believed that living elsewhere would offer the solace and freedom she craved. So she resorted to a drastic measure, a fabricated lie, one so devastating that it shattered her family completely. At 13 years old, Rena accused her father of sexually abusing her. She claimed that he had been physically, mentally, and sexually abusing her at home.
Holy fuck, I did not see that coming. I thought you were going to say she ran away.
No. Particularly horrendous story that she told involved being hit with a hammer, tied to a chair, and threatened with a heated barbecue utensil. Her father, Manji, was arrested on the charges of sexual abuse, and she was removed from her parents' custody. She was then placed into a foster care. Rena's father denied these allegations completely, and the charges were later dropped because Rena herself admitted that she had lied about the abuse. Okay. The lie kind of just took off and went way further than what she wanted it to. Her family was seriously concerned for Rena because if she was claiming that she was getting hurt and they weren't the ones doing it, maybe someone else was doing this to her. So they pushed for a full investigation so that it didn't leave any stone unturned, just to make sure no one else was doing this. So this goes on for quite a long time. And then eventually Rena, you know, she missed her family and realised the mistake that she'd made, and it didn't make school any better, it made it worse. So she tried to fix the broken relationship that she now had with her parents in the hopes of one day being able to return home to live. She's at her foster family's at the minute, and she asked her foster family if every so often she could spend the night at her parents' house. So they're gradually kind of making contact again.
Yeah.
Rena still craved her parents' love and support, as now the bullying was escalating again. Classmates subjected her to relentless torment, including placing gum in her hair, mocking her appearance, and issuing threats of violence. Additionally, she faced accusations from local teenage girls who accused her of spreading rumours and attempting to steal one of their boyfriends.
Kids are so cruel.
Really cruel. Teenage girls in particular can wield immense cruelty through manipulation and falsehoods. Even if they aren't physically violent like their male counterparts. You know what I mean? Like, girls are so sneaky as fuck and horrible and can make your life hell. Whereas boys
psychologically,
tend to,
it's horrendous.
Yeah. I know that boys can do that to each other as well, but it's usually a fist fight and then it's kind of all done with.
Yeah.
Or for the day at least, whereas girls, it's constant mental torture.
Bitchy. Yeah. Horrible.
And bitchiness, yeah. Rena's experiences are the real darker side of being a teenager, which brings me to the day of the 14th of November 1997. Rena found herself at her family's home. She was visiting for the day and she was going to sleep over. So she was going to spend the day with her loved ones. However, a phone call changed her plans as she was invited to a social gathering, a rare occurrence for her. So eager to seize the opportunity to belong, Rena joined the festivities in a field behind the high school, where a sizable group of 50 to 60 teenagers had gathered, indulging in typical teenage drinking, smoking, and just having fun. Amidst the crowd, Rena saw acceptance and companionship. Despite only knowing a few of the attendees, however, the evening took a dark turn when the police turned up to, like, make everyone disperse following a noise complaint. The large group broke up into smaller groups, and some of them relocated to Craigflower Bridge. And this is where everything would come to a head. Suddenly, a group of seven teenage girls and one teenage boy formed a ring around Rena, screaming at her about alleged rumours, calling her horrible names. According to one of the girls, Rena had recently stolen her notebook, which had the phone numbers of several boys in the area. And then she said that apparently Rena had called these boys up and told them lies about the girl, saying that her eyebrows were fake, she was ugly and had AIDS. So yeah, apparently Rena did that, which is a load of poo. But even if it was, why would a boy care if someone, random a girl, rang them up and say, hey, she's got fake eyebrows and she's ugly and she has, like, totally has AIDS.
She's totally got the AIDS.
Yeah, she's definitely got AIDS. So this girl was furious when she found out that Rena had done this.
Which she hadn't.
So that's when she hatched a plan to, like, confront Rena at this get-together. That's when one of the girls, Nicole Cook, stepped forward and put her cigarette out in the middle of Rena's forehead.
Ow!
And then they pushed her to the ground and began to punch and kick her.
Fuckers.
Once the fight broke out, many of the teens gathering decided to leave, not wanting to get involved with any of the trouble, whereas others ran closer to see what was going on and so that they could watch the attack. Yet nobody stepped in to help Rena or try and put a stop to it.
Where are all her, like, baddie friends?
I don't know if... Throughout this, she never really seemed to have proper friends. They were always kind of her friends, yet bullying her, and then ish her friends. And I'm not sure... She didn't know a lot of people there. And then when they all kind of split up, I don't know if they all... You know, if any of her friends were there.
Okay.
It doesn't really go into it when I was looking for it.
But nobody's helping this poor girl.
No one's helping. Everyone's an observer.
Which is absolutely shocking. Jesus Christ.
Rena was crying out, saying that she was sorry, but the attacks continued. She laid on the ground, bloody and battered, but eventually she was allowed to get up and she tried to get away. She was limping away across the bridge, going in the direction towards her home where she could get help. But two of the teenagers, 15-year-old Kelly Ellard and 16-year-old Warren Glowatsky, they weren't going to let her get away so easy, so they followed her. Before she could escape, they grabbed her again. They pushed her down the embankment and then smashed her face against the floor, picked her up and smashed her head against the tree. They dragged her towards the water under the bridge, beat her even more, and then held her head underwater until she stopped moving. Rena was gone.
They killed her?
They killed her. They drowned her in the river under the bridge.
Jesus Christ, man. For nothing?
That was just two of them. Yeah. That was two of them on their own. A lot of the crowd just saw her get up and walk away. They didn't see her get grabbed again. That's when a pact was made between the seven teenage girls and the one boy that was there. No one was to talk about what had happened that night, as they all could be implicated in her death. Meanwhile, at home, Rena's parents worried about their daughter not coming home, and they called the police. Because of the situation, the police were a little bit reluctant to believe that she had disappeared. They didn't take it seriously because she was a 14-year-old girl who had a history of rebellion and troubling behaviour. The police believed that it was very likely that she had run away. Thankfully, teenagers talk, and the horrific secret that they had tried so desperately to keep quiet, rumours started going around the school, people started talking more and more, until eventually the police found out and quickly learned about the fight that had broken out and the gathering around the bridge. And also, there was a shit ton of witnesses. So even if those group of teenagers kept quiet, everyone else was there.
Oh yeah, it was only a matter of time. There was no way that was not coming out.
And even between the six of them, or seven
no,
of them,
yeah, no
someone
way.
Would
yeah.
say something.
Absolutely.
So eventually the rumours got back to two Russian sisters who happened to live at the same foster home as Rena did. And it was them that actually called the police with the tip after they heard the rumours that Rena was most likely no longer alive. It would take 8 days for the police to locate Rena. Her battered, half-nude body was found in the water under the bridge. While many of the teens were aware of Rena's fate, her parents were just now learning about this.
This is horrendous.
And the violence inflicted upon her.
God, can you imagine knowing your child had gone through that? Oh my, I'd kill him. I'd kill him.
I was so enraged when I was...
This is awful.
Writing all this down. An autopsy would reveal that poor Rena had sustained multiple blows to her abdomen. She had extensive injuries to her face, her head. She even had a bruise in the shape of a sneaker on the back of her brain.
Oh my God.
So somebody I didn't even stomped. Know that was possible.
Somebody had stomped on her head.
With such force that it bruised her brain in the shape of their foot.
That is...
horrific.
These kids aren't normal. Like, kids are cruel. Kids are mean. Don't get me wrong, but this is another fucking level, man.
It's horrific.
They're like animals.
I think a lot of this is also massively racism as well, because she was Indian and most of these children are white. And that was a lot of the source of her bullying as well, was ridiculous. The way that she looked and her ethnicity. So ultimately, Rena had died from being drowned, and pebbles were found in her lungs, indicating that she was still alive when her head was pushed into the water. But the coroner did note that if she had not been drowned, she likely would have died from her other extensive injuries because she'd been beaten that badly.
Jesus Christ.
Her injuries were so severe, it was as if it was compared to those of a car crash victim. The whole community was completely shocked, especially when they learned who amongst them had done something so evil. In total, 7 of the teenagers that were present were prosecuted in relation to Rena's murder. Their names were Nicole Cook, it was her with the cigarette in the beginning, Nicole Patterson, Missy Grace Plyke, Courtney Keith, Gail Ooms, Kelly Ellard, and Warren Glowatsky. 6 of the girls were convicted of assault causing bodily harm and sentenced to up to 1 year in custody. But only Kelly Ellard and Warren Glowatsky were charged with Rena's murder.
I suppose it's impossible for them to really figure out who gave her...
that blow at the back of the head. Mm.
Well, I mean, it's not because she's got a bruise the shape of their fucking foot on her brain. But yeah. Which blow was the death blow, which was the blow that she wasn't going to recover from.
She was drowned. So I know it was drowning her that killed her. Yeah.
But hang on, what do I mean? I know she was drowned.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
But if she hadn't have been drowned, like you said, she would have died. So the drowning was almost like...
putting an end to it.
Putting an end to it, but it was going to happen anyway. So whoever had given her that injury should have been done for murder as well. Do you follow my train of thought?
Yeah. But she was hobbling away after the initial beating. So I reckon possibly the head to the tree or the second beating that she endured.
So you really think it was just those two that did the most?
Well, I don't think the other ones. I think the other ones definitely deserved more than a year. And that's in custody. So was that home prison? You know, when you were at home? Fuck knows. Then they're just growing up. They're all 15. So a year takes them to 16. They've got everything to do after that. They've got the whole life ahead of them.
If they have any decency in them whatsoever.
I just don't think they feel guilty.
That haunts them. You don't?
No. I just think people like that be like, oh, it was like... a mob mentality and we all just kind of joined in and I was forced to do it and they just wouldn't be sorry about it. I just think they use that as an excuse.
Oh God, I don't know. I was hoping it would haunt them as adults.
I hope so. Now they're adults and possibly have children of their own. I hope the thought of what they did to that girl scares them about their own children. Yeah. So Warren Glowatsky was ultimately convicted of second-degree murder in 1999 and sentenced to life in prison, with the possibility of parole after 7 years. His first request for parole in 2004 was denied. Warren had a troubled home life. His mother was an alcoholic. His father had left and moved alone to California, leaving Warren behind. At the time of Rena's murder, he was living with a friend. It's not clear why exactly he had involved himself in the initial assault of Rena, or why he joined Kelly Ellard in the second attack, because he actually didn't know Rena.
So he was just, yeah, he was just...
just in it for the violence.
Just in it for the violence. Either that or,
you know, yeah. At her first trial in 2000, Kelly Ellard was found guilty of second-degree murder. However, the Supreme Court of Canada later overturned that decision on technical legal grounds. So there was something wrong with the trial. I don't know what it was. A second trial in 2004 resulted in a deadlock jury and a mistrial. At this trial, Kelly Ellard insisted that she was innocent, telling jurors, "I'm not a monster."
Oh, diddums, I'm not a monster. Piece of shit.
Anna. In 2005, however, a third trial saw Kelly Ellard convicted, fucking finally, and she was sentenced to life in prison.
Thank fuck.
Yeah. Following the tragic loss of their daughter to a brutal murder, Suman and Manjeet Virk emerged as prominent advocates against bullying. Their relentless efforts persuaded the government of British Columbia to implement several anti-bullying initiatives in schools, earning them the prestigious Anthony J. Holm Award of Distinction in 2009. While serving his sentence, Warren exhibited profound remorse for his role in Rena's death, discovering his Métis heritage. So he was a blend of European and indigenous. He had so he was a mixed race lad.
But he did. Do you know what? Fuck off. Just fuck off. You're a racist piece of shit. And then you find out that actually you're not, 100% white, and you're like, oh, actually, white. I shouldn't have done that.
Oh, actually, no. I feel it now. Yeah.
Just don't be a racist piece of shit.
Yeah. So his path towards redemption led him to personally apologise to Sunman and Manjeet Virk. So in 2010, Warren earned full parole as a decision that was supported by the Virks. So they supported his parole hearing.
Wow.
And they're bigger than me.
Absolutely. Bigger people
but
than I am.
But he actually did show true remorse and really bettered himself in prison.
Yeah. Don't bring her back, though, does it?
No. But prison is about reform, if for people that can be...
reformed. Yeah, yeah.
Put back into society. In contrast, Kelly Ellard maintained her innocence throughout her incarceration, engaging in illicit drug smuggling and repeated violations of prison regulations. The parole board assessed her as posing a moderate to high moderate risk of reoffending, and she's still incarcerated. Yet, for some reason, she managed to have children because she gets conjugal visit.
Okay.
But that annoyed me. But she's still in prison. But she does not. She's just a piece of shit. Should have shoved her down a toilet where she belongs. And she's not taking any responsibility for her role in the whole thing. And there is a dramatised, I think it's a film called Under the Bridge, which I couldn't bring myself to watch, which is about Rena's story and what happened. And I reckon that'll be a hard watch.
Yeah, it sounds like. I mean, it was a hard listen.
Yeah, listening to the story, I don't know if I'll want to watch it, but apparently it's
very good.
I think it hits home hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my story for this week. And it just sounds, it's so mean that it sounds like a film. You know what I mean? They killed her over a notebook.
Yeah.
That she didn't even wasn't take. Even true.
They killed her over a lie.
Even if she did, she's got bad eyebrows and has AIDS, which is obviously not real. She doesn't deserve to be beaten to death and drowned in a river.
It's horrendous. The level of violence is shocking.
And just the minute that she got into Canada, she was bullied the whole time by pieces of shit.
When you said the whole community was shocked, I was like, were they though? Because kids aren't born racist, right? So it's a learned thought process. Oh, yeah. So their parents, yeah, at some point, or some parents at least, have instilled that thought process into their children. So why are they shocked? You know, you've brought your kids up to be racist piece of shits, so...
Yeah, try and bring your kids up so they don't beat people up and drown them in a river, please. Or make them the people that would actually say, no, stop, let's not beat up a girl.
I can't believe nobody did that.
I don't know why anyone didn't step in and be like, hey, what are you doing?
Yeah.
There's seven of you, one of her. Girl or boy, anything. You know, it's wrong. So that's my story for this week. Poor little love.
Well, thanks, Becky.
Yeah.
Poor Rena.
Yeah.
Shall we let the people go?
Yes.
So, if you enjoyed today's episode, which we hope you did, could you please leave us a review or a 5-star rating? That would be much appreciated. You can follow us on Twitter and TikTok at @SCSK_podcast. You can find us on YouTube and Facebook under Spine Chillers and Serial Killers. And you can email Becky at chillers.killers.pod@gmail.com.
Yes, you can do that.
Please,
I mean,
please
even
do.
If you don't follow anyone, but on any of the podcasts or anything, it really makes a difference to a little tiny one like us.
Little tiny baby
if you'd
one.
You'd like to
it
do
does.
It.
It does. It does indeed. Yes. All right, then. Stay safe.
Don't kill people.
And keep it weird.
Keep it weird. Admissed the crack. Admissed. How do I say that? Admissed the crack. Admissed.
The D is at the end. Admissed.
Hang on. Well, why am I saying at the beginning? You're right. Admissed. Admissed the crowd.
Admissed. Oh, fuck. Is it
no,
at
it's
the end?
Admissed. It is near the end. Yeah. Admissed. Admissed the crowd. Amongst the crowd, shall I just say.
She's in a crowd. But when he was there, he noticed a donut-shaped UFO fly... Blah, 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 blah.